I want to introduce you to one of my old sponsors. Is our warm-up speaker tonight. For our warm-up speaker, we'll have Wyatt C. from Laguna Woods.
Incredible. Just look around you. I want you all to just take a deep breath of this incredible breath of fresh air out here. It's incredible. Take a deep breath. Feel that you are alive. For the newcomers, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. You are home. My name is Wyatt, and I am an alcoholic. And if you don't hear anything else tonight, and it's really not important that you think that or know that, but it's real important that I know that. Because if I were not an alcoholic, I wouldn't be here. And I have no idea where I would be today. I sure wouldn't have what I have that has come to me through this program and through the people in it, and through my sponsor, who I love dearly. And you're going to hear about him. He likes phone calls real early in the morning. Because alcoholics don't like to call, you know, at normal hours. We like to call real early in the morning. I come from a long line of alcoholics. My mother was an alcoholic. She died from the disease. My stepfather was an alcoholic. He died a horrible alcoholic death. He cooked himself next to a gas heater in a blackout. My father was an alcoholic. And you'll hear part of my story where I was out with my father, my cousin, who Lynn sponsored, and myself, and we all went out to dinner, and they weren't drinking, and they were trying to get my dad to come into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and so I helped myself because I was drinking. And that night, Lynn told me, he suggested that I give him my car keys, and I, you know, we're not real responsive to other people driving our personal cars. So I wouldn't give him my car keys, and he looked at me and he said, "Well, why, if you ever think you might have a problem with alcohol, AA has got a solution." And you know how receptive I was to that. That's fine. You all need it. I'm fine. I'm doing great. I'm having fun. The kind of fun I was having at the time, and I heard a guy say one time, alcoholism has three stages. There's fun. There's fun and problems. And then there's problems. In the fun stage, I had an airplane. Lynn loves this part of my story because I like to fly. I was a part of Baja Bush pilots and Flying Samaritans, and we used to fly down to Baja, my wife, and my wife hates this story, by the way. She thinks it reflects poorly on her and her judgment.
Not as much as her marriage.
And her selection of a mate. Anyway, we'd gone down to Baja and flown some friends down there, and we'd stopped off at this little town. And you know, you can't drink the water in Mexico. But they had some beer, so we put a few cases of beer in the plane. Actually, it was about four six-packs. And it was warm, and we took off from down in Baja and headed to San Diego. And, you know, five or six beers at 10,000 feet have a hell of an effect. And, you know, I decided we really needed to get down. Now, I called, you know, we're coming into Ensenada, so I called up all the airports there, and no one was responding. I looked down there, and there's the airport. I said, well, let's just go on and land. So, did you know that Mexico has an Air Force? I didn't, but we landed at the Mexican Air Force base in Ensenada. Now, I got to tell you, this was a long time ago. And if you did that today, you wouldn't have a plane, and you wouldn't have gotten back to California. But we were met with military jeeps and armed guards with machine guns, and they took El Piloto in to see the commandant. The commandant was dressed like he looked like Mel Brooks in military regalia, and he'd been drinking. Fortunately for me, he refueled our plane, and we headed back to San Diego. And we got to San Diego, and we had to clear customs, and this lady came out, and she was looking around. She didn't have anything to declare, and I said, no. She said, well, what's in that burlap sack? And I said, lobsters. And she said, my ass. So I opened up the bag, and she looked in there, and about that time, this antenna of one of the lobsters popped up, and she screamed and dropped her flashlight down in the bag. So she sheepishly said, would you get the flashlight? And so I got out of there, and I managed to get home. That was fun. Last time I drank, I went out to buy a hunting rifle and started drinking, and I ended up at a bar, a little pub that we used to go to, and I called my wife's girlfriend to talk about my wife's problems. Really. Unfortunately, she took a long time to get to the pub, and by the time she got there, I was holding court on the floor. And they stuffed me in the car, and they took me back to my house and dumped me in the driveway. And I stuck my hand in a fire ant pile, and I'm sitting there drunk with fire ants going up my arm, my wife and my two kids inside the house, and I'm thinking, what is wrong here? And I just somehow, in the back of my mind, it dawned on me that I heard those words. If you think you might have a problem with alcohol, AA's got a solution. So the next day I was at my desk, and my head was down on the desk, and I was looking at a Rolodex. And here is Lynn's number that he's given me. And he was my cousin's sponsor. Now, I'm going to tell you, 1981 was not a good year. And that's when I got sober. 1981 started out, my cousin went back out after several years of being sober. And he shot himself and killed himself. And I had to come out and clean up his effects. And I was in his room, in his apartment, and it had been one of those Santa Anas that had come in, and he'd been in there for about 7 days dead. And I went in there, and an Eskimo showed up. I mean, it's the most critical. You're going to hear, in my story, you're going to hear God. This guy showed up out of nowhere. And he said, you need some help. I said, sure. He had a truck, he had a trailer, I piled all of my cousin's stuff into the trailer and took it to the dump. And I went to get some money and hand it to him, and he was gone. And that just scared me. So I went and did what a good drunk would do and had a lot of drinks. Anyway, So I'm at my desk, and my head's on my Rolodex, and I'm looking at it, and I call up this guy, Lynn. 4 o'clock California time, 6 o'clock. I'm living in Texas at this time. 6 o'clock in Dallas. And Lynn says, "Where are you?" I said, "I'm at my office." He said, "Great. Don't go anywhere and don't drink." But I wonder why he said that. And then he said, "I'm going to call someone." He called this Jewish dentist named David A. And David became my sponsor. My first AA meeting I went to, and they said, you know, they're talking about these sponsors. I thought, man, this is some kind of a country club kind of deal. You got to have a sponsor to get into this thing. And one of the guys said, I said, "How do you go about getting one of these sponsors?" And he said, "Well, if you can't afford one, one will be appointed for you." Yeah. I can't tell you the life that has been given to me. Now, I would love to tell you that it's just been all uphill, everything's been just wonderful. And my sponsor reminds me, he says, you be grateful for everything God's given you and everything he's taken away. It took me almost 28 years of sobriety to go completely bankrupt. I mean bankrupt, broke, dead broke. That was about 6 years ago. You know, you can survive bankruptcy in sobriety. God also decided that he'd hand me the health card. I've got kidney disease. And you're going to hear something. This is incredible. So I had this, I'm reading this article about this company that I put money into 15 years ago. And they've come up with a drug that was specifically meant for people that have kidney disease and for anemia. And I got on that trial, and I've been on it for 3 years. And that's why I'm standing up here tonight, because it has been amazing. God, it says God will do for you what you cannot do for yourself. This is not a life that I wouldn't have even been known how to invent this life for myself, let alone live it. I've got a beautiful daughter here tonight. And I can, you know, she's got her own story, and I won't tell it for you, but she's a miracle. She's got 26 years of sobriety. I've got another daughter my oldest daughter lives in New York. I think she's got 13 or 14 years of sobriety. I've got a beautiful wife today. We have been married 42 years. Same wife. That's, you know, how does that happen? I'll tell you, it happens through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. You're going to hear from a guy here tonight that has been, you just look at the way God has woven lives together. And the people, all of you that are here tonight, are new, are feeling that you're not part of this, you're separate, you're alone. You're not alone anymore. You know, there are no musts in this program, but, you know, we beg of you. We beg of you. The only way you can find what I've found is through the steps. And and the traditions and the sponsors and the people in this program. There is no other, there is no easier, softer way. This is the easier, softer way. And I fought this program. I've made every kind of mistake imaginable. And I love every bit of it now. It has given me a life that's, and six grandkids, four daughters, one wife, an ex-wife. My ex-wife even, you know, texts me every now and then. We're good friends. I mean, it's just, you know, what a life. Anyway, I love all of you. I want to thank Rick and Carol, the Breath of Fresh Air group, for putting this on. It's a beautiful evening. We brought the rain in for you. There's a sun that's there's a sun that's setting. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you.
Hey, that's it is now time to introduce our featured speaker for this evening. This is a wonderful, wonderful gentleman, a very good friend of mine, part of my old home group in Orange County, as was Wyatt, a great men's stag. If any of you are ever down there, the Anderson on Thursday night over in, where the heck is it now? In Irvine? Newport now. That's right. It's St. Andrews. Anyhow, 49 years sober, well into his 50th year. Will you please welcome Lynn W.
Hi, everyone. I'm Lynn Wilder, and I know I don't look like one, but I'm an alcoholic. And I'm delighted to be here. What a treat. I want to thank my good friend, Rick. I'll always be alcoholic, Evans. And I want to let you in on a little secret. He always was an alcoholic. You know, I sat here tonight, and I walked around just looking at the group. And then I sat down and I watched the clouds and the reflection of the sun. And I thought, what a blessing. What a gift. And I treat every day of my life as a gift that I was given on March the 5th, 1965. Deneen and I drove up this morning and it was a beautiful drive. And, you know, I reflect more and more. I think with the more years I get in Alcoholics Anonymous and as I get older, and as we came up over the grapevine and in close to Bakersfield, and I looked over and, I've been to Tehachapi a number of times, and they have an annual conference there. Once a year, and a lot of the H&I people go in, about 450 or so, for a one-day conference, and I've had the privilege to participate in that. I participated a lot in the Bakersfield area. I was fortunate very early in sobriety to start taking commitments, and I didn't know what that meant. I had no idea that I was being of service. I just know that it made me feel better. That first coffee commitment I had, the first time, and back then, we smoked in meetings, and I was able to clean the ashtrays out. I was able to pick the butts up, and I could get a little of what I could see in your eyes. And I didn't know what that meant, but I know today. And I got involved in my home groups. I got involved in different types of committees. I got involved very early in the Southern California Convention. And in 1971, I was nominated as the chairman of the Southern California Convention, and it was in Bakersfield in 1972. And I remember all of that. What a blessing. We only had two conferences in Southern California back then. We had the Southern California Convention, we had the Palm Springs Roundup. And you know, that year at Bakersfield, we registered 6,700 people. That's a long time ago. We've got conferences and gatherings all over everywhere now. And you know, I come to this tonight, and it doesn't get any better than this. I told the dean, we were talking on the way up, that, you know, I had the privilege of carrying the message and listening to the message all over the North American continent and even over the pond. Forty-nine years ago right now, after two men had taken me out of a maintenance shack where the bottle had beaten me to death, literally beaten me to death in Los Angeles. And they had put me in a detox, the only detox in Los Angeles, other than County Hospital, and I'd been there also. And I was brought out of that detox and taken to a place called the Bimini, which is still around today, which is a halfway house. There were three in Los Angeles then, and one in the valley called Chandler Lodge. I'd been 86 from all of them, because I had to continue to drink wine, and the wine that I continued on, I can assure you, never saw a grape. But 49 years ago, right now, I was a dishwasher at the Bimini. I don't want to forget that. I never want to forget from whence I cometh, because I know where I am tonight as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And as I walked around tonight and looked and went inside, and you know what it reminds me of, and I said it to Rick and I think a couple other people, it's the fellowship that we have here tonight. And it's the fellowship that kept me sober before I could really start to get into the basics of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the people around me that reached out to me. And I see these young people today. I saw those two that read. And you know, it's amazing to me, because I want to tell you, 49, 50 years ago, we didn't have a lot of young people in Alcoholics Anonymous. We've got thousands today, thank God. And how this program has grown and how it's spread. And we get to sit here tonight and have that wonderful tri-tip and have the fellowship and the auction and everything that went on. And that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is all about. That's what life is all about. That young lady that came up with one day, God love you. You're home. You don't realize that, but you're home. I've never met anyone in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous or a gathering that was here by mistake. We got a lot of people back here that have got 30 days or less. Welcome. I hope you stay. I was first introduced to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous 51 years ago this past Christmas Day. I had become a blackout drinker. I came to on the south side of Atlanta, Georgia. I did not know that it was Christmas Day. I was crawled up in the fetal position and right out of school. I had gone to work for a big company in the southeast, and a man was in that company that was whispered that he was a member of AA, and I wanted nothing to do with him. But this particular Christmas morning, I called, and he and his wife on Christmas Day came and picked me up and brought me through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that was not my last drink. I've talked a lot of places. I've talked in the oil fields one at something similar to this one night. And we'd had a big barbecue, and there's a crowd about like this, and they had a country western band. I'm going to talk quick because I hear we've got some real pickers that are going to go on in the barn, and I want to get in there and hear them. Because I tell you what, I'm a Californian by residence, a Kentuckian by birth, and an alcoholic by absorption. So I'm got a little hillbilly in me, and I want to get in there and hear the music. But in that oil field that night, I was talking at an annual deal and everything, and the band started to warm up before I finished. So I tell you, for about the last 15 minutes of my talk, they were playing and I was talking. Tehachapi. We came down, there are a lot of vineyards up here now, all the way up. I've never had the opportunity to speak in the middle of a vineyard. And for an old wino like me, I think that should happen sometime. I came into the world and was given every opportunity that a human could ever want in life. Every opportunity. And every bit of that was taken away from me. Every single bit of it. The benefits of a good education, the benefits of an athletic career, all of my family, all of my friends, everything was taken out of my life as a direct result of a disease called alcoholism. A lot of people tried to help me along the way, and it went in one ear and out the other. When that couple in Atlanta took me through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't want to be alcoholic, and I certainly didn't want to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was young, and I thought I was okay. And I can look back today. I've learned everything in retrospect. I can look back and see very clearly the progression of my disease, what went on. And you know, I could even see before I took a drink the ism part of my disease. I came out of the chute with the ism. I can look back and see choices that I made, people that I hurt, even before I took a drink. And when I took that drink, the disease was complete. And yeah, a little of it was fun for a while. But I remember very clearly as I look back when I crossed that line from controlled to uncontrolled drinking. And I remember the things that started to happen in my life. And I could see the progression so clearly. And I grew up in a wonderful family. We hear a lot around Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've heard a lot of four steps. People that really come from a lot of dysfunction in their lives. I come from dysfunction too. You're looking at it. And I don't want to forget that. But you know, I got out of that environment. It was like letting midnight out of chute 9. I loved everything that went with drinking. I was a party animal. I loved the bar scene. I got in a lot of trouble in bars. I got in a lot of trouble at parties. And more of it happened. And I was a runner, a drinker, and a drunk. Because I was all over this country with my disease. And that first job I got, I lost that job as a direct result of the disease of alcoholism. I had an athletic career, and fortunately, another door opened. I got re-involved in athletics. And here I was, a leader of men every day and a drunk every night. The Jekyll and Hyde that we know so much about. I lost that job. Because they were asking me the same questions that other people had started to ask me. Why do you drink so much? Why do you say the things you say? Why do you do the things you do? Why do you act the way you act? I knew they knew. And when I knew they knew, if I couldn't leave quickly enough, they fired me. And I lost that job, and I was pulling a little trailer and going back through the mountains of Tennessee to where I'm from in Kentucky to a family business that I'd walked away from. I said, no, I don't need it. That's the only option I had. And I was young. And I looked around, and most of my friends were married, and I said, that's the answer. And here I am, an insecure, immature, irresponsible drunk. Unfortunately for the lady that was involved, we got married and we had a baby out of that marriage. And fortunately for them, they were able to get away from me pretty quickly. I didn't see that daughter for 10.5 years as a direct result of my disease. And I had to go on from there. And I could stay up here all night and take you all over, in and out of different places with this disease, but I'm not going to do that. I left Texas, got off an airplane to LAX. I'd never been to California, and I came out of a blackout. And that was in 1964. And the next 7.5 months were on the streets of Los Angeles. And I told you up front that I finally ended up in a maintenance shack, sleeping on a mattress. And the reason I was in the maintenance shack was that I was at a place called the Cecil Hotel, which is still around today, and it's a Skid Row hotel. Interestingly enough, it is where the first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in 1940 started. A man named Mark Joseph started the meeting there. And I'd been put out of that hotel. Not by the hotel, but by the two winos I was living with. And I was in bad shape. The mental, emotional, spiritual side were gone. I was holding on to the physical part of the disease because I had an athletic background. And the bottle had beaten that to death. And this lady saw me on the street and came up to me, and she was a social worker. And she knew I was in bad shape, and she took me to this place at the corner, very close to the corner of 3rd and Vermont in Los Angeles. And this man would always give me a bed, and he gave me a bed for a little while. I had no money. I had warrants for my arrest in 4 states. And finally he said, Len, I can't keep you here. And he knew I had nothing. And he's the one that said, I've got a maintenance shack out back, and you can stay there. And I was paranoid and sick and in DTs, and at night I would walk to the corner, and there was this pavilions on one side and a Rouse on the other, and I would go in and I would steal meat, and then I would take it back in and exchange it for wine. And that's where I ended up. And this social worker went home and you didn't know what to do, called her family doctor. And he had a patient that was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And this man and another man came and got a key and unlocked that maintenance shack. I didn't call. The bottle had beat me to death. I tried to get up off that floor and tell them who I was. And I was a sick, dying drunk. And they were to put me in the detox I told you about earlier. I knew Alcoholics Anonymous didn't work. I knew that there was no God, because if either of those things were true, why was I in the shape that I was in? I cried out in silent desperation to no one in particular lying there for help. I did not know that I had my last drink, but I had. They kept me in that place for almost 2 weeks, because I was in bad shape. And that's when I was released, and these men arranged for me to go back to the Bimini, which I'd been put out of, and I became a dishwasher. And all I was capable of doing was not drinking and sitting in meetings. And we'd sit in meetings there or at a couple of the other recovery houses that were under this foundation. There was a Royal Palms, which is still around today, in a place called the Shoreham. And they would take us to meetings in Los Angeles. And I was rummy and sick. And when these two men came to get me, there was no one that cared or knew where Len Wilder was. Boy, has that changed today. What a gift. What an absolute gift. I was to hear a man talk very early, and my only thought was, no one can live the way this man talks. About 3 weeks later, I was to hear him again in West Los Angeles. They'd taken us there at Ohio Street. He came over to me and said, son, how you doing? I said, terrific. He knew better. He wrote his name on the back of a card with a phone number. He said, I want you to call me in the morning. It said, Chuck C. And he gave me a number. This is 49 years ago. I didn't know who Chuck C. was. I didn't care. I didn't call him. I was taken to his home group. Not long after that, I was still at the Bimini as a dishwasher. It was the Beverly Hills Men's Stag. And he came over to me and said, you didn't call. I said, no. He said, if you don't call me tomorrow, I'm going to call Pat. And Pat was the founder of these recovery houses. He was an ex-cop, and he was tough, and I was afraid of him. So that's the only reason I called Chuck. And I didn't know that was a couple of the other men that had taken me out of that maintenance shack. And with Pat and some others, they'd arranged, because Chuck said, I'd like to come pick him up once a week and take him with me. And he would come to the Bimini and pick me up and take me all over greater Los Angeles, and everybody loved him. And he was carrying the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they would give me a pass sometimes, and I would ride the bus and transfer and go to his office and get in his car and go with him. The old-timers that carried the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to tell you, and there are certain things you have to do. You have to do when you get to Alcoholics Anonymous. You have to get a sobriety date. You have to get a home group. You have to get a sponsor. Yes, you have to get all of those things. I've always had a sponsor. I've never changed sponsors. They've died. I've got one today, Dave Cook, who has 57 years. He's 86 years old, and I tell him that all the time, and he says, don't worry, I'm going to outlive you. But it's so important. I had no idea. And I told you about the fellowship. I just hung on. We would get in cars together and take panels, or we'd go to different groups, or we'd be in coffee shops before the meetings. We'd be somewhere else after the meetings. It's so, so important. Every one of us sitting here tonight, you could turn to the person on either side of you or turn to the people in back of you. You could say, could I talk to you? And you could go talk to them, and what you could tell them, I can guarantee you they'd experience themselves. This is an inside job. We all drank and used for the same reasons. And that's where we have to go to work. On the 12 steps, which Wyatt mentioned, of Alcoholics Anonymous and the 12 traditions are just as important. That's the foundation. Our co-founder, Dr. Bob, in 1937, before the book was written, put on that prescription pad three things. Trust God, clean house, and help others. That hadn't changed. Trust God, clean house, and help others. That's the simplicity of it. You get into the workings of the 12 steps. It's so important. But the thing about one drunk talking to another, the way these two men started it, is still true today. You may think there's some things that you can't tell other people, but there aren't. Because if you tell one of us, we know all about it. I had so many secrets when they brought me back to Alcoholics Anonymous, my secrets had secrets. When we come in here, we uncover, we discover, we discard, and we recover. And that's the process. You're home. You're scared to death, but you're home. Hang on. Hang on to one another. Hang on to your sponsors. If you don't have one, get one. Hang on to your counselors, whatever you've got. But you don't pick up that first drink. We've got to get that. We've got to get that. And then life's in session. And there are bumps in the road in life. As wonderful as things can be, there are bumps in the road with all of us. But if we got the foundation and we've got each other, we can weather anything that comes down in life. I can tell you that because I've been through most of them. I met a lady the second year in Alcoholics Anonymous that was fantastic. She was young. She'd come back and had gotten sober at 25. She was an incredible, incredible lady. And we were to fall in love and get married, and life was good. And we were to move to Laguna Beach. Late 1971. And everything really kind of centered around everything we did, around our home and all about living sober. And I told you about that daughter that I didn't see for 10.5 years. My original sponsor, when I got to the 8th and 9th step, I made that list. I left her off. I knew I'd left her off. He knew I'd left her off. And I went on. And he finally reminded me, what about your daughter? I said, oh yeah. I hadn't forgotten. I still had that fear of rejection. Fear of abandonment. And I didn't know how to handle that. And he told me exactly how to do it, and I did just the opposite. Because you see, I'm a manipulator. And that's never worked for me. And I finally was pulling a lawyer off bar stools in Los Angeles, pretending to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all I wanted was visitation to see this daughter in Chicago, and I got him. And I called her mother, and I said, I'm coming back to see Gail, and that's our daughter. And I'll be there at such and such a time, and I hung up, and I got on that airplane, and I'd done everything but take a drink. I was on the worst dry drunk that I've ever been on. I got off that plane, checked in a hotel, and you taught me well. I called Alcoholics Anonymous. They said, you're 2 blocks from a 6 p.m. meeting. A place in downtown Chicago called the Mustard Seed. I walked those 2 blocks and sat in that meeting and walked out of there less crazy than when I walked in. And I went back to my hotel room and I called her mother and I said, what time can I pick Gail up? And she said, Lynn, she doesn't want to see you. Thank God it happened that way. Because I sat down, I got on my knees that night and I said, God, you take it. Show me what to do. I got up and wrote them both a separate letter of amends and I walked down to the lobby the next morning, got stamps and mailed them. I got on that plane, came home, and I was given another freedom. I stayed in touch with that daughter. On her birthday, at Easter, Valentine's Day, I wrote her notes. About 10 months after that, her mother called and said she'd like to see you. I was doing business in New York and a lot on the East Coast then, and we arranged to meet at the airport at O'Hara in Chicago, and I was going to fly from New York, and we took off, and they said we're not, and it was a flight that was going to land in Chicago, and then I was going to catch a later flight back to California. And the pilot said, there's such a blizzard going on, we don't know if we're going to be able to land in Chicago. We were able to. I was convinced she would never get to the airport. She did. And I sat across the table from her. And that line of communication opened. And you all had told me to tell the truth. The simplicity of telling the truth. And you know what? I had difficulty with that sober for a little while. a great guy, Catholic priest named Father Ted Hatton. He's been years for been dead for years, but he helped me with that. Just little nickel and dime stuff. Just tell the truth. And I was able to look her in the eye and tell her that I loved her and ask her what I could do to help her. And I got on that airplane, I came back and walked in my home. Shortly thereafter, she came to California. And she graduated from high school, and she's been in California for a lot of years. Because of this gift, I was able to put her through college. Her mother came out with her new family. Pam and I had two children then, and we sat at her college graduation. As she walked up on the stage to get that diploma, her mother turned to me and said, "Lynn, I can't thank you enough." I said, "Don't thank me. Thank Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank Alcoholics Anonymous." And she went from there to law school, and she's been a practicing attorney for a lot of years in the greater Los Angeles area. She's an incredible woman. In 1984, things were good in life. I'd talk on a Saturday night at a conference in Florida. I went to the room and called home, and my wife's mother answered the phone. And I said, "Why are you there?" She said, "I'm with the children. Pam's in the hospital." I immediately called the hospital. She said, "It's nothing. It's a lower back pain." I got on an airplane in the middle of the night and headed home. It was something, because 10.5 months later, she was dead. It was leukemia. And we spent most of that time at UCLA. And you were there, all of you. Members of Alcoholics Anonymous, members of Al-Anon, members of Alateen, and I had the great privilege then of co-sponsoring an Alateen group. You were there giving blood. You were in Laguna taking care of our children. You were there doing whatever you could do. And I've watched that go on throughout the years. The unity that we have here amongst our fellowship. We help one another. That's what we do. And what a gift that is. And when she stepped into the next room, we were all there. And you know, life goes on. I didn't know what the mothers of the world did, but I was to learn very quickly because I started to grow with my kids. And you know, sometimes they were a little ahead of me. And I would sit and talk to them at night, and we would cry together. But little by little, that process went on. I had a lot of financial difficulties then. I've been in business on my own for a long time. I became willing, and willingness has always been a key for me, and I got an opportunity to go back in the corporate world. And I got up every morning, and I drove to downtown Los Angeles. I'd get up at 4:30. And I would go to downtown Los Angeles, and I'd hit the freeway, and rather saying, "Why me?" I'd say, "Thank you, God, for the opportunity. Thank you, God, for the opportunity." And you know why I talked about it? You know, I thank God every day for all he's given me and for all he's taken away and for all he's left. There are a lot of things I don't understand that go on in life. But that's where we get to the acceptance part of the program. And I have found that sometimes we have to accept things that we don't understand and we don't like. You can fight them. You can fight them as long as you choose to. But sooner or later, they're going to take you to your knees and you're going to have to give them up. And life's gone on from there. I mean, they're all grown now. Deneen and I have 5 grown children. We have 5 grandchildren. And you know, we got difficulties in those families. We got current difficulties. But you know, nobody could do it for me. Nobody could do it for you. We We have to allow them to figure it out, just like we've had to figure it out. And you've heard it over and over again, and that is that God has no grandchildren. And sometimes I question whether God's presence is amongst, at least in my life. But I never quit doing what I do on a daily basis. And I start every day with prayer. And I've got an imaginary box, and Wyatt knows about this. We talk about it. And another group we belong to called Al-Anon. And I just celebrated 28 years in that group, and it's changed my life. But we talk about an imaginary box, and every morning, if I don't think about it before I get in my car, I think about it before, right then. I need to step in that box. And everything in that box is my business with God's help. And everything outside that box is none of my business. And I have to remember what that 12th tradition talks about, principles above personalities. And I talk to God sometimes during the day. And I end every night as I lie in bed next to my wife with prayer. And I'm doing a 10th step, and I don't even think about the 10th step. But I've been through the step, but that's what I'm doing. Is there anything that I need to clear up that went on in my life today? And if there is, I clear it up immediately. Because you see, I want comfort in my life. I want balance in my life, and it took me a long time to get that through this fellowship and through the fellowship of Al-Anon. But I've gotten it today, and I'm so grateful for that. Yeah, we've got each other. We talk to one another. We stay on the path together. We're all on the same path. Don't be afraid to dial that telephone. Don't be afraid whether you've got one day, 30 days, 40 years, in between anything. We need one another. One drunk talking to another. That's what we're all about. And the greatest thing, and Chuck taught me this, he went out every day of his life to see what he could do for others. And little by little by little by little, and I watched his example, and I watched other people's of the old timers. I got that. Didn't come easy. But I finally got it, and it's ingrained in my soul and in my heart. I don't even have to think about it. I do it not only for you members, but I do it in every day of my life, in the workplace or wherever. I ask people what I can do to help them. Because the more involved I am in your life, the less involved I am in mine. And you know what? That works. That absolutely works. I want to tell you two quick things, and then we're going to go in here and list some kickers. Chuck used to talk to me a lot about his relationship with Bill, our co-founder. And his wife's name was Elsa, and she was a surrogate mother to me. I loved her. And about his and Elsa's relationship with Bill and Lois. And I used to tell Chuck, oh, I'd love to meet Bill. We had not moved to Laguna. Matter of fact, Pam and I had not married. And he called me right at my third birthday and said, Lynn, Elsa and I are going to be in Connecticut. If you can get back to New York on Monday, I'm going to be at General Service Office with Bill all afternoon. I still get goosebumps telling this story. I got a ticket on the red eye. I got off that plane in New York and took a cab and went to the old General Service Office in New York. And I spent the afternoon listening to those two men, Bill Wilson and Chuck Chamberlain. And I cannot tell you how that penetrated and stays with me today. And that night, they asked me to have an early dinner with them, and I did. Bill and Lois and Chuck and Elsa, and I caught the red eye back. And Bill said to me as I left, son, if you ever come back to New York, you call me. And he had started to have some health issues then. And I'd start doing a little business in New York, and the next year I was going back, about 10 months later, as a matter of fact. I said to Chuck, I'm not going to bother him. He said, you better call him. So midday, I had a meeting canceled in New York, and I picked the phone up. I called the General Service Office. I just started to talk. I said, this is Glenn Wilder from California. I'm going to leave a message for Bill. Yak, yak, yak. They put me on hold, and the next voice I heard was Bill's. He said, where are you? I told him. He said, get in a cab and come down here. I got down there. He came out the lobby and got me, took me in his office, and he shut the door. He had two sandwiches and two bottles of Coca-Cola. He talked to me about nothing other than the 12 traditions. Now, I would like to tell you, I knew a lot about the 12 traditions. I knew nothing. But I knew a lot more when I walked out of there. I've never forgotten that. But he talked to me in particular about tradition 11, tradition 12. He loved the part about anonymity. He was, you know, and even after he died, Lois continued on with that. I was so blessed. But not only that, but about the old-timers and the people that carried the message, and the people that are newer that come in today that still carry the message to me. I can be sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous or an Al-Anon meeting, and I'll hear someone share that's relatively new, and I'll think, where'd they get that wisdom this quick? But that's what we do, you know. We identify with one another. We share with one another. That's the glory of what we have here. I got to know Lois pretty well. I met her in Arkansas in about 1974. We were leaving Dallas, Texas. One Sunday night, we'd both participated in about 1977. We'd both participated in a conference. She was flying to New York to go home. I was flying to New York on business. I asked her if I could sit with her. She said, please. I asked her this question. I said, Lois, what do you think the most important thing is we have to remember? She thought for quite a while, and she said, Lynn, I think it's the willingness to let go. The willingness to let go, which is easy to say and tough to do. But I haven't forgotten that. And you know, the last time she was in California, she talked at the Palm Springs Roundup. And she was the Al-Anon on the family group at the family meeting, and I was the alcoholic, and we took her home with us. And when Pam died in 1985, Lois was still alive. And she called me the next year. She had the people from Fishkill, New York, call me and said, asked me to come back to the annual celebration. I said, oh, I can't do that. I've got too much. I've got young children. I've got a lot of financial difficulties. But the next day I called back, and I said, I'll be there. And thank God I went back for that. We're blessed. All of us. I've got a lady with me tonight, 16 years ago, in the corporate world, she walked into that company. People kept asking me, have you seen the new lady? She's great. I hadn't seen her, but I heard her laughter. And then I saw her and I went, wow. And I took her to lunch. And I tell you what, another gift you've given me here with the females. You had taught me how to be friends. And that wasn't my M.O. You know, I was always in the attack mode. But you taught me how to do that, and we became friends and before we became lovers. And what a blessing she is. She didn't know that I didn't drink. We had a lot of fun together. We had a lot of things we liked to do together. And she thought I drank. She didn't know that. One night I had on a coat and tie. Friday night, I'm going out. She said, where are you going? You got a date? I said, I was leaving the company. I said, no, I'm going to speak. Speak? About what? I said, I'm going to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I'm an alcoholic. She looked at me and the blood just ran out of her face. She said, what? I said, yeah, come on, you want to go? She said, I couldn't do that. I said, it's an open meeting. It's birthday night at St. Jude's Hospital. Oh, no. Well, I talked her into going. And they put us right up front. And we walked in there, and there's enough energy in there, you'd think the roof was coming off. And she'd never heard my story. And that meeting was over. She didn't look right. She didn't look left. we left there and we went for coffee, and she looked across the table at me and she said, "Do you think they thought I was alcoholic?" I said, "Are you kidding? They're so self-obsessed they didn't even know you were there." And she's the love of my life. I told her today, we have so much fun together. We're just blessed. Even with the things we've got going on in our life right now, and we've got some things going on that are difficult. But you know, I know that whatever's going on in my life, and I have this thought today, I know it's going to change. And I can guarantee you what's going on in your life today, whatever it may be, is going to change. I'm not going to tell you how it's going to change, but it will change. Because you see, God could and would and does. This has been a real treat for us. And God love all of you. And I'm going to close with a story I always close with, because I'm just up here yakking tonight, but it's what I like to close with and what I really like to share. And it's the story of a man that owned a fine Swiss watch. And he loved it more than any possession he'd ever had. And it would quit running on him, and he would wind it, and it would quit running, and then he would wind it and quit running, and he took it to several watchmakers. And he knew not what else to do, and one morning very early, sitting in his den, he had his little desk lamp on, and one more time he's winding that watch. And he turned it over and started to put it on his wrist, and he thought he saw something that looked like a couple of scratches. And he got out his magnifying glass. And there weren't scratches at all. It was false inscription. And it said very simply, "In case of trouble, return to Maker." In case of trouble, return to Maker. Because you see, God could and would and does. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love being sober. And I love all of you. Thank you.